Hello and welcome to For the Love of Truth. This is episode 230. And today I'm having another conversation with Nigel Howitt of Lawful Rebel. And if you've not seen any of Nigel's work, I would encourage you to get across to either his website or his YouTube channel or his BitChute channel. I'll put links in the description and the comment of this video. And the purpose of the conversation today was I knew that Nigel had embarked on a journey to improve his health several years ago, and I was curious as to where that started. And Nigel explained that it was an awareness of the dangers of mercury fillings, the amalgam in his teeth, that started him on this journey that he's been on now for some time. And during the conversation, we covered dentistry, and then we moved on to other aspects of health, particularly focusing in on the real health benefits of things like intermittent fasting and fasting in general. And Nigel has considerable experience of both of those. And I hope you enjoy the discussion as much as I always do with Nigel. You guys are absolutely amazing, and I look forward to speaking to you and seeing you in the next episode. Take care of yourselves. Bye-bye. Nigel, thank you so much, mate, for coming on the show once more. How have you been?
I've been very well, thanks, Adrian.
Good.
A little bit busy at this time of year, but all good.
Yeah. That's right. You have a small holding, so there's lots of planting and stuff to crack on with and other things as well, I guess.
Yeah, we're busy with the planting season, and we're busy with a few developments on the small holding as well. And then there's homeschooling and things like that on top, and, you know, other things going on. So whole basket of things.
Never a quiet moment.
Indeed.
So the question I had for you, Nigel, was you clearly at some point took responsibility for your own health, and it, I presume, revolved around dentistry from previous discussions with you, but I don't really know too much about that story. Could you share that with us?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. It was dentistry that sort of served as sort of a doorway for me into you know, becoming more health conscious in general, I think, really.
Yeah.
It was, I'd always been sort of, you know, mildly aware of the need for to look after yourself, but I think it's around about 15 years ago when I heard that mercury amalgam fillings were a really bad idea in your face. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, that's it, when somebody sort of tells it to you like that, and you think, oh, gosh, yes. And this chap who had cured himself from cancer and by a process of detoxification and a few other techniques. And he was quite persuasive in showing me that something that's considered toxic on the workbench of the dentist is okay when it's in your mouth, and you know, or allegedly it's said to be okay.
That's right.
And
yeah.
You know, there's a bit of head scratching, and I thought, oh, you got a point there. But I mean, like these things that take a while to sort of percolate in your mind and sort of take root. It wasn't until I think around about 2011 that I really started taking positive action. And thought, I must get these amalgams out. So that thought was sort of bouncing around the inside of my head for a few years. But yes, initially I went to my conventional dentist and broached the subject with him. I said, look, I've got a face full of amalgam fillings. I had really bad teeth, basically. Ate far too much sugar as a youngster, didn't look after my teeth, and paid the price with all sorts of things in my mouth. And I'd had a couple of broken teeth as well from an accident when I was a kid, and they were turned into root canals. And my conventional dentist was, he thought, oh, right, yeah, I'm happy to do that. And he sort of booked me in, and I happened to sort of Google the sort of protocol of mercury amalgam filling removal. Mm-hmm. And I was alarmed to see that it was quite an involved procedure. You know, it was quite... there's a lot to do there to protect not only the patient, but also the dentist.
Mm-hmm. Which, again, when it's out of your teeth, is becoming dangerous again, isn't it, funnily enough?
Yes, but also apparently the vapors as they drill the mercury out, and that can, you know, that's obviously a threat to anyone in the room. Mm-hmm. But my conventional dentist was very blasé about that, so I sort of withdrew from his care and decided it was time to, you know, to pursue the issue elsewhere. Yeah. But I should just say that I didn't really have any, you know, major chronic health issues that drove me to that. Mm-hmm. It was more preemptive. although I had a history of suffering from psoriasis, you know, the sort of eczema skin condition, mm-hmm. and also from migraine headaches. Mm-hmm. So those were my two health issues, if you like, that, mm-hmm. that I was dealing with, as well as a fair amount of middle-aged gathering obesity. I basically had metabolic syndrome. I used to have a very round face.
Really?
You know, just, yeah, the extra. I look at passport photographs of myself back in, 10 years ago plus, and yeah. I'm very round-faced. And obviously, I've lost all that now. I've lost a fair amount of body weight too. Uh-huh. So there was metabolic syndrome going on there in the background as well. So, yeah, I got into this. I got enthusiastic about getting this toxic load out of my mouth.
Mm-hmm. It's a good place to store it, right next to your brain, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is one of the things that I was told by this chap who cured himself of cancer. Mm. You know, and so yeah, I began this process of trying to find a holistic dentist when I noticed that the protocol for removal was quite exacting, shall we say. Mm-hmm. And I found a good holistic dentist up in Bedford, mm-hmm. Called Graham Munro Hall. And he immediately put me on a nutrition and supplement program. And I was thinking, you know, I just want to get the amalgam fillings out. Mm-hmm. You know, what's all this about? And that was a real wake-up call because, you know, the more I consulted with him, mm-hmm. and he was very, very thorough, he really opened my eyes to the importance of nutrition, and therefore, you know, knock on diet. You know, not only do you need the right things, you know, he opened my eyes to this idea, but you need to not eat the wrong things.
Yes.
And it really sort of ignited a fire of curiosity, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But I was horrified when the procedure came around. It was actually in 2012. Sometime early summer 2012, and it was coming, you know, this last consultation before he was actually going to take the mercury amalgam out.
Yeah.
And he pointed out to me that you really should take out those root canals as well, and I had a couple of teeth that were problematic, and the thought of just pulling them out, you know, made me aghast. You know, I thought, I'm not sure I'm ready to pull teeth out. Mm-hmm. But sure enough, I had loads of amalgam fillings. It must mm-hmm. have been about 13 or 14.
Wow.
And he dealt with all of those, but he ended up actually pulling five of my teeth out, you know, and mm-hmm. The upper set. And it was quite traumatic, but
you don't say.
he educated me about the need to not have dead things in your jaw,
yeah,
and the fact that a root canal, you know, when they sort of drill the nerve out of the tooth and they drill right down to sort of get all the debris out, mm-hmm. And then they sort of flush it out with sort of toxic substances to try and kill all the bacteria.
Yeah,
but he showed me that the structure of a tooth being a bit like a honeycomb, a mm-hmm. bit like that. What's that sweet that people eat, crunchy bar, yeah. Here in the UK anyway.
Yeah, same structure as bone.
Yeah. And full of tiny little holes and passageways, which apparently are ideal for bacteria to grow in. So I was fairly readily convinced that these root canals needed to come out. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that all happened, and I ended up, you know, being five teeth short of a full set in the front rack, which was bad news. And I, you know, it took me into the realm of having to wear a denture plate and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah,
but really, that was the beginning of a real eye opener in mm-hmm. terms of nutrition and all of that. And it started me on a, I think probably about 5 or 6 year period of quite intense study. Mm-hmm. Pretty much like yourself, you know, just you delve into one thing and it leads to another. And
as long as you're curious, yeah, I mean, some people don't want to know, but if you're curious, then yeah, it's a never ending quest, really, because you keep refining it. You get the kind of basic building blocks, get rid of all the toxicity as best you can, start to detoxify the rest, and then concentrate on not taking too many more toxins in.
I found it kickstarted my whole experience with mercury amalgam filling removal, mm-hmm. and the teeth being removed. It was the protocol that Graham Munro Hall, the holistic dentist, gave me. And he was saying how important nutrition was, how it was important to not only get the right building blocks, to he wanted to bring my health up, or my immune system's functionality, more specifically, up to a certain point before actually, you know, exposing me to the mercury amalgam and all the toxicity, which, you know, to some extent you're inevitably re-exposed to when the amalgam fillings come out. And so that was a real eye opener, and it just started me studying nutrition, and I just couldn't put the ball down after that. I really picked it up and ran with it. I found it so interesting, because I don't know how it was for you or how it is for other people, but I suddenly became aware that I had this body that needed to last me a good long time, and I didn't know how to manage it. In fact, I didn't know what it needed. I didn't know how to look after it. And that was the thought that sort of hit me sort of square between the eyes. I thought, geez, I don't know how to look after myself. And that was a really sobering realization. So it triggered, you know, this 5 or 6 year period of trying to find out how does my body work, you know, what do I need to for its best maintenance? What is health? How do I achieve it? And it was a really, really interesting journey.
There was a book, actually. Is it called Nutrition and Physical Degeneration by Weston Price?
Yeah, that rings a bell.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I think it is that book. There's some interesting kind of things we could add to the discussion with that. One of the ones, I'm pretty certain it was that book, although I've read that many, it might not have been.
My dentist actually told me about that book. That was one of the ones he referred to.
Yeah, there's an interesting thing in there that when they go back and look at the cranial structure and the jaw structure and the tooth structure of the races around the world that didn't have any access to Western diet, that they had very wide jaws, full teeth, no overcrowding, no problems with wisdom teeth, and no tooth decay. And it was only the Western diet later on that caused that. And there was also things in there like one of the things I didn't realize at the time, but it makes perfect sense, is this business of where a tribe, maybe a guy would have 6 or 7 wives. It was to give the wife's body time to recover and get enough nutrients and raw materials ready to build the next healthy child, so that you didn't keep building more and more deficient and poorly structured children, because the child can only be built out of what the mother has in reserve.
Yeah, that makes good sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, and there was one other thing as well, which was really interesting. What was it to do with? No, it's gone. It'll come back anyway. But I mean, that was it. There's one of the tribes where they'd celebrate when a woman became pregnant. And then they would allocate 2 tribe members that their sole responsibility was to go and fish, catch, and grow certain materials that they knew had the minerals and vitamins that the woman required to make a successful baby. And if you had a baby that wasn't healthy and strong, it was your own fault for having one too soon before you'd recovered everything in your body. And I know that my daughter, when she went for surgery several years ago, a corrective surgery, I said to her, look, the last time you had surgery, it was really bad. This time, could we work together and rebuild your entire system nutritionally so that the trauma it'll have an impact, but it will be less damaging as an impact? And she was supposed to be in hospital, I think it was for 3 days, if I remember rightly. And we took her home the next day.
Wow. Well, that's a result.
You know, it's all to do with that. It's about you have this thing you inhabit that you express and explore your life through. When you start to really get to grips with it, and it's not that complex, you can start to get more and more stuff done and better health, because it's self-repairing. It doesn't need a lot. It just needs the right stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, when you point out there that the Weston A. Price, that the dentist, the things that he discovered about the people that were not eating the Western diet. Yeah. And I think that was the main common denominator, wasn't it?
That's right.
It wasn't that they were all necessarily doing something obvious. I mean that they were, but the really blinding common denominator was the fact that they weren't eating, you know, sugar and processed flour and processed oils.
That's
and
right.
All these sorts of things, you know. So
and to be fair, they were probably eating far less. I've just read Man's Higher Consciousness, And that's a really interesting book. You know, we're all breatharian in terms of we can't do without air. We die. We can go without water for a length of time. We can go without food actually for a heck of a long time. And I know that you're in favor of fasting as well, and that there are tremendous health benefits for actually consuming considerably less food. And it's really got me thinking that actually much of food is just another toxin. It's a habit. And much like smoking, when you smoke, you want more of it. Or when you drink too much, you end up wanting more. It's habit forming. And I think eating's habit forming too.
Yeah, I think it is. You don't need three full square meals a day, do you? And snacks.
No.
You know, I think it's one of those classic myths that we're sold is that it's that you should graze little and often sort of all day.
Yeah.
But there's a good deal of evidence that, you know, when you start to look into insulin and things like that, there's a good deal of evidence that suggests that continual eating and that continual sort of spiking of insulin at a meal is ultimately bad news over you know, the years and the decades.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, it's an interesting thing for me because I started intermittent fasting about a year and a bit ago, probably a bit longer. And so all of a sudden then I was eating probably 70% of the amount of food I was eating before. And I did lose weight. I lost about 20 pounds or so. And then more recently, I've been pushing the envelope a little bit just to see what would happen. Then I read that book and I thought, I wonder what happens if I just eat one meal a day. So I'm probably down to eating about 40% or even 35% of the calories I used to take in a day. And I haven't lost any more weight. But I do have a lot more energy in terms of logic in my head. If we really needed the amount of food that we're told that we do need to have, three squares a day or whatever, that with me eating 30 or 35% of the calorific content that I was eating before, I should now weigh considerably less than I did before, and I should be very low on the energy. And yet what I've found is the opposite is true, and I bet you found this when you fasted too, is that you have more energy, more clarity of thought.
Absolutely. Fasting, I think, is really misunderstood. And it's counterintuitive, isn't it, that you feel more energized and you feel more mentally sharp when you're fasting?
Yeah.
Or at least it's counterintuitive on the surface. Because
I think it's counterintuitive, Zion. Sorry for over-talking you. If we're taught that we need food as our fuel source, but what if it wasn't a fuel source? Then it starts to make sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, certainly not the sole fuel source.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I found that when I thought a little bit more deeply about it and thought, well, you know, it wouldn't make sense, you know, for our ancestors when, you know, they didn't have 7-Eleven and fridge freezers and all of
that. That's right.
The 24/7 availability of food that we have, if they were growing it, if they were nomadic, you know, there would have inevitably been times of hunger.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't make sense. The human race wouldn't have survived if as soon as you got hungry and didn't eat for a few days, you got tired and brain fog and curled up and died. Mm-hmm. I mean, that wouldn't fly.
No.
So it kind of does make sense that you sharpen up because you need to sharpen up and you need energy. In order to, you know, if you're hunting or if you're even just trying to make it through a winter gap until your next crop, you know, is ready to harvest.
Yeah.
It makes good sense. And of course, when you look into the, you know, the metabolic activities of the body in terms of burning fat as opposed to burning sugar for fuel or glycogen, then all of a sudden it becomes clear because everyone's body, even if you're fairly lean like I am, everyone's body has effectively long-range fuel tanks because we've all got plenty of body fat. You know, unless you're really emaciated, you've got a considerable tank of fat.
Yeah.
You know, fuel tank. In that, you know, you can access that fat for you know, living, you know, for weeks on end, if not months.
Yeah, it's very efficient too.
Yeah, it's a more efficient fuel, isn't it, and a cleaner fuel. This is one of the things that fascinated me, is that when we're burning sugar, which is what most people do, obviously, all the time, when you're burning sugar, body is primarily metabolizing glycogen or sugar. Mm-hmm. It's like that sort of dirty old bus chuntering along the road, you know, chuffing out black clouds of smoke and everyone's going... You know, and you look at that and you think that's metabolically what your body is doing.
Yeah.
You know, when we're gorging cake and orange juice and pizza and pastries and all these sorts of things all the time. And then when your body's burning fat for fuel, when you're consuming a high fat diet, it's a really lean burn. So it's the amount of toxic clear up that the body has to do is hugely reduced, and the amount of the mitochondrial damage, the sort of reactive oxygen and reactive nitrogen species firing off in your mitochondria, is massively reduced when you're burning fat. I found that such a huge insight.
Yeah,
and it steers my diet to this day. I try to remain in ketosis and cycle in and out. So I do like to have my roast potatoes on a Sunday, and then I don't eat ketosis all the time. But I think it's something that people would do well to look into, burning fat as a primary fuel as well as glycogen.
I think you're absolutely right, and it was funny because even when I was going down my initial kind of health forays 20-something years ago, I still thought that carbs were good. And it was only probably a year ago, really, that I really started to dig into the ketosis stuff. And I was like, oh, crap, I've really been going about this the wrong way. But it's, I don't know about you, but what I found is as I've gone more down that route, you actually crave the sugars and the carbs. All that craving goes. And I've noticed, like today, I didn't eat for... it was probably nearly 24 hours since I had my meal until I just had some stuff before, that I didn't have any hunger pangs at all during the day, nothing, which is a really interesting thing. Because if you were living on carbohydrates, you'd be in pretty rough shape, I would think, sort of 18, 20 hours into it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, fasting can be a challenge if you're unused to or if your body, shall we say, is metabolically unused to burning fat, because it will have that craving. And as soon as you have that sugar crash, when you've used up your stores of glycogen in your muscles and in your liver, after about 24 hours, it can get really painful. But your body adapts. And this is the wonderful thing about it. And another one of the counterintuitive things about fasting is that people say, oh, aren't you dreadfully hungry after 4 days or 5 days or even 2 days? It must be excruciatingly uncomfortable, and the reality is that it isn't. And again, if we think back to our ancestors, how inconvenient would it have been when you're waiting for these crops to grow? You might have some stored food, you might have some animals, and you would have had fat products which were highly prized by our ancestors. It would have been very counterproductive to continually have your hunger sort of banging at the door saying you gotta eat. And of course it doesn't actually work like that when you're fasting. After day two, day three, you don't actually feel hungry. It's as though your body kind of adapts, and it doesn't say anything to itself, but if it did, it would be saying, well, okay, there's nothing coming down the chute now, so I'd better just switch over into this different mode metabolically, and we'll just adapt. And that's what happens, and it's great. So fasting is more achievable than perhaps people think. For that reason as well.
And it's certainly in a lot of the research I've done, nearly not all, but so many very serious health problems can be dealt with effectively with fasting as part of the protocol.
Yeah, that's awesome, isn't it? I mean, I remember talking to Professor Thomas Seyfried, who has written a wonderful book called Cancer as a Metabolic Disease, which he challenges the general consensus out there in our current medical sort of paradigm that cancer is a genetic disease. It's an excellent book, but he recommends, on diagnosis of cancer, which is fairly sort of up there as one of the major life-threatening diseases of our culture, he says one of the best things you could do would be to immediately embark on a 7-day fast. Don't eat anything, and that would give your body the best chance. I mean, there are slight mitigating circumstances if somebody is already extremely lean, if they're in advanced stages of cancer.
There are
complicating factors, but for somebody of ordinary build like you or I, if you ever were to get such bad news, Professor Seyfried was saying a week of ketosis would be the best thing you could do.
Yeah. It's like in that book, Man's Higher Consciousness, they have stories in there of people that have fasted sort of 8 years out of 10 years. I mean, literally that whole time. And they're still in incredible health and vibrancy, in fact, better. So that really got me thinking about this whole issue of toxicity. And then when I was talking to Claudia the other night, and she said, if you look at the root of stomach, sto means, what did she say? Let me just look it up because we went through it earlier on. It was really interesting. Let's see. Can't find it. That's a shame. Sto meant, I think still, and Mac was machine. So it basically meant, we kind of interpreted that to mean that you only use your stomach for fuel if you're not moving. Otherwise, you're generating energy otherwise. And that makes sense. And you'll find this, and I do too, that if I'm very physically active, I don't get hungry. And I can quite happily, you know, go a very long time without, because I'm just making energy as I go. It's really interesting, especially if I'm outside in the fresh air. You did a fast at the beginning of this year, didn't you? Is that something you've been doing regularly, or something you've decided to incorporate newly into your regime, as it were?
Well, it's something I've been doing for about a year and a half now. And it was actually through studying on gut health and coming across the idea of a colonic irrigation.
Done plenty of them. That's an interesting experience.
Yeah. I had quite a severe health incident where I suffered from constipation. And, you know, it was due to my lifestyle at the time. And I was unaware of it. I mean, this is the crazy thing. I was unaware that, you know, I'd stopped going for that morning constitutional, as it were. And I ended up with really severe abdominal pains. And I went to A&E, actually, on two different occasions. They didn't diagnose it correctly until I was in there, I think, the third time. That was when they diagnosed it. And they were giving me morphine and these things which actually exacerbate constipation. But eventually it was diagnosed, and it was a real wake-up call. I mean, I suddenly looked at my lifestyle and what I was doing, and again, it opened another avenue of research. But I ended up embarking on I had a course of colonic irrigation, which remedied the problem very effectively. But I also learned that because the colon is such an important organ in the body's detoxification process, where the liver, you know, dumps toxins overboard, I now have a colonic irrigation and a coffee enema three times a year. And in order to maximize the benefit, I tend to do at least a week fast prior to that treatment. So I now do one in January, one in, you know, May, another one in September. So it's become a regular part of my lifestyle, to you know, optimize my detoxification process.
Okay, that's really interesting. So how do you feel after the colonic irrigation? Because I know I felt just kind of really light and enlivened, and it was bizarre how much better I felt afterwards.
Yes, absolutely. Well, these days I don't notice it as much, but I think on the second visit, probably my first treatment after, you know, the constipation episode, I was driving home, and this was quite bizarre, Adrian. It never happened to me before, but I was driving home. It was probably about 25-minute journey from there to home, and I felt so emotional. It was indescribable. Emotion was just welling up inside me. Not any particular issue, but I got to the point where I hadn't got home yet. I was probably only 2 or 3 minutes from home, but I had to stop the car and pull over and just, you know, take a few deep breaths and I don't know what you'd call it, process, deal with, experience, you know, this wave of emotion just, you know, cascaded over me, and I was crying, tears coming out of my eyes. It was an incredibly powerful experience that I really couldn't understand. And when I reported this back to the practitioner, she said, "Well, that fairly often happens as a result of this, you know, very significant clear out."
Yes,
You know,
of material that could have been there for decades.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there have been analogies drawn to sort of decades of old wallpaper that needs scraping off when you're redecorating.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, it doesn't go anywhere. It builds up and it builds up.
Yeah.
If our you know, if our lifestyle choices, our state of hydration and other factors, you know, how many bowel movements we do in a day or a week for mm-hmm. some people, these things can have a
three a day,
you know, very detrimental effect. Yeah. I mean, I try and about two or three a day for me these days. And I think that's good. And I've heard that that's, you know, pretty much optimal for keeping things clean and functional. I mean, that's the point of it, isn't it? It's to get that detoxification process running on all cylinders.
Which comes back to what I was talking about with food being a source of toxicity, that in my experience, nature isn't particularly wasteful. It's very plentiful, but it's quite economic with its resources. So why is it we produce so much waste?
Yeah.
Just I don't know why it's floating through my head, but it's bouncing around in my mind so much because... And thank you for clarifying that experience. I presume when you're going through your fast, there must have been some interesting emotional moments too, because 7 days is a reasonable time to do that.
Yes, it is. And for early, when I first began fasting, I did have some pretty emotional and challenging times.
Mm-hmm.
Things like irritability, you know, the family were quite ready to give me feedback on that one. But it is challenging, and not for reasons of hunger, as I mentioned a moment ago, but for reasons of food addiction. I think that's what I was really going through. Mm-hmm. And I've experimented with some quite long fasts, and the longest one I've done is about 2 weeks, 14 days. And there is a food addiction thing to break through, which you know, can pull up emotional issues and so forth. But that was that cleanse out was certainly the most powerful emotional experience I've had in that respect, which certainly trumped the fasting experiences.
I found with
fasting that after a certain number of days have passed, after a week, it's pretty easy to go an extra day. And then you think, well, I could probably go a couple of extra days, you know, and it gets easier and easier. I mean, it sounds kind of crazy, but the more your body adapts, you know, it actually gets quite easy. I did have one experience when I reached day 12 about a year ago, and I just threw it away. For some reason, I needed to eat. I was aiming for 2 weeks at the time, and I just threw it away. I didn't feel good. I didn't feel good like I usually do through the fast. And I thought, you know what, I need to throw this away and eat. And I did. And, you know, that was okay, you know. So I'm not sure what was going on there, if I'm honest. But I think it did teach me to at least, you know, listen to my body and
100%
not
I was gonna
be afraid
say that.
To throw things out. Yeah, when you need to.
Yeah, I think that's extremely good advice, that you need to pay attention to what's going on and be prepared to adapt and change.
I mean, it's funny, you were saying earlier about when you reduce your calorie intake, it's surprising that you don't lose more weight.
Yep.
And it's incredible that the body has such an ability to maintain a stable, normal, should we say, weight. Because I found that when in ketosis and when burning fat as a primary fuel, it doesn't matter how much I eat, I never actually put on any weight. I mean, I don't know how it works, but the idea of a calorie controlled diet where you're measuring calories in and, you know, you're running on a treadmill to try and burn a few extra, you realize that this is all just nonsense, because your body, I don't know how it does it, but it does, obviously through greater appetite control, I think. Mm-hmm. And when you're eating a higher fat diet, or I've found when I'm eating a higher fat diet, it's just easy to eat what you want in terms of quantity and just not even think about it. And I find that my appetite works in a way that perhaps it's being prevented from working when I'm, you know, eating normally, should I say, and perhaps, you know, with more carbs and sugar. And don't get me wrong, I mean, I love sugar and I love chocolate, And, you know, I struggle to rule those things out of my life entirely. Mm-hmm. But it is interesting. I found that my body weight really stabilizes mm-hmm. if I'm in ketosis, you know, for a period of several weeks, say a couple of months at a time before mm-hmm. having another party day and perhaps a sugar indulgence day, which I think is important. I mean, you have to live a little too. So,
yeah.
You know, again, it's all about balance, isn't it?
Yeah.
Good. Some people say everything in moderation, even moderation. And you know, maybe there's some truth in that because, I mean, I do find occasionally the problem with fasting, if you can call it a problem, I find that the better I get at abstaining from certain things, and, mm-hmm. you know, discipline is an important part of nailing down a healthy lifestyle, but I do find sometimes maybe a consequence of these fasts is I have had a few sugar binges, you know, where, you know, I might have two bars of chocolate in a day and a bag of 12 bites or something, and I think, oh my goodness, you know, I've really maxed out on chocolate. Mm. And then I hate myself for a couple of days. But it seems that I dive in extra deep into the indulgence. You know, yeah. I don't know whether that I'm psychologically rewarding myself for, you know, times of abstinence. I don't know. It's a crazy thing. But
it's an interesting thought.
Yeah. All in all, I think it balances itself out, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and I think that's important. It's all about, I mean, you've got to enjoy the process. Otherwise, why would you do it? It shouldn't be hard work. I don't do anything that I find particularly unpleasant or difficult unless I know it needs doing for a specific goal. But there are ways, like, you know, when I get up now, so I'm probably eating only for 2 hours a day, sometimes not that. And I've eased myself into that. I haven't just gone, right, that's it. So when I got into intermittent fasting, I'd already worked out pretty much at the weekend. I was busy doing stuff, doing errands, you know, cracking on doing things. And I realized that I wasn't having breakfast until 2 p.m. anyway. And I thought, well, I'm sure I could push that to sort of 2:30, 3:00 and just do that every day instead of just at the weekends because I'm not missing it. So that was an easy step. And then I stuck with that for a long time, probably near a year. And it was only recently when I was reading that other book. And I thought, I want to, you know, push this along a little bit further. Maybe I can get to, you know, eating once a day and maybe every 18 hours or every other day, something like that. Just see how I do weight-wise and see whether I get benefits. Because I'm just looking for benefits. I'm only looking to say, am I going to feel better? Do I feel more vibrant? Is my mind clearer? And if I get those things, absolutely. Yeah. You know, so it's all about paying attention to that and not punishing ourselves, which is what I think a lot of us fall into that trap, and I think that's also part of conditioning of life, that you expect to get punished because you've been punished your entire life anyway.
You mentioned intermittent fasting, and I think that's a really good way to, if anyone was considering a fast for a detox or for, you know, whatever purpose, intermittent fasting is a great small step towards it, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It really seems to help the body sort of pre-adapt to burning fat as a primary fuel, and give you that little bit of metabolic flexibility.
Yeah, well, it's like the way I imagined it was you've got this big circuit breaker that's either burning glycogen or burning fat, and it's been stuck on burning glycogen. It's gone all rusty and it's stuck there. So you've got to start working the switch, get some lube in there, and keep doing it. So in my simplistic approach to that was if I do this every day, stretch it out a little bit as and when I feel like doing a fast, if I actually do want to do one or not, I don't know yet. Maybe I'll just keep stretching the time out on this and we'll just see. But it's like anything. If you ease into anything, you're capable of amazing things. And if you run hard and really hurt yourself, you won't want to continue with it.
Yeah, that's true. And yeah, I mean, as you were mentioning a few minutes ago there, the idea of not sort of you can't throw all the enjoyment of life out of the window, and I think this is where it can be very difficult for people who are trying to change diet, which, let's remind ourselves, I think is the most powerful lever that we have to exert benefit on our health. It's the big control knob that's I think exerts most control. Obviously, the other things are important too: exercise, hydration, sleep, etc.
Yeah.
But it can be a real challenge when people think, well, goodness me, I really love pizza, or, you know, how can I give up my 11 o'clock donut in the morning, or, you know, and it is hard. So I think it's worth remembering that even if we set ourselves small targets of, for example, you know, clean eating, as I refer to it for myself, for maybe just a week to start with, and then, you know, reward yourself with whatever your poison at the end of that week, and then maybe stretch it to 2 weeks or 3 weeks.
Good choice of word.
Yeah. Choice of poison, yeah. Yeah, I mean, because it does have to be sustainable, yes, doesn't it? And this is the thing. I think it's okay to fall off the wagon. And I don't know about you, Adrian, but I've fallen off the wagon loads of times over, you know, I probably first really tried to change my diet and all of my other lifestyle choices permanently. I tried to change them permanently, or I intended to. I set out with the intention of permanently changing them, mm-hmm, probably first up about 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I still haven't got there, but I'm happy that I'm considerably nearer to an ideal or an optimal state than I was when I first began. So you do a little bit, you fall off, you just keep getting back on, really. I think that's for me was a really important component of it. Don't give up, don't throw it away. And I found that as long as I kept really valuing good health, and as long as I kept reminding myself that I don't want to be in a hospital when I grow older. I don't want to need the NHS. I don't want to need them at all. And I think it's very possible for almost all of us to get to that point where our long-term well-being is pretty much catered for, you know, by an empowered sort of control over our own lifestyle choices. Diet being the big one. So we have to be gentle, don't we? We have to allow ourselves to fall off that wagon periodically, just keep getting back on.
I think that's really solid advice, absolutely. And just keep heading in the right direction, you know, because when a plane's on autopilot going from here to, say, America, it's actually off course all the way. But the autopilot's constantly making little tiny corrections to keep you back on course. And that way you actually arrive where you're getting to. Whereas if you didn't make those corrections, you could end up in a really interesting destination you hadn't expected.
Yeah.
And I think it's the same for health. Just keep making those little corrections. I'm tweaking the thing all the time. And I can tell now, it's funny, the further down the path you go with it, if I stray, I can tell almost instantly I've eaten something I shouldn't have eaten, because I can feel the energy drop substantially as my body's trying to deal with it.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's important to acknowledge that we're probably all suffer from some kind of addiction, and I've struggled with this, and my weakness has been, you know, a bit of the sort of evil weed, and
not evil,
deemed to be evil, certainly the illegal stuff, you know, the green stuff,
it's medicine.
And I've struggled to sort of contain it, shall we say, and keep it in its box, I like to think of, and just get it out occasionally. And the problem that I've had is that it really affects my control over all of the other aspects of my lifestyle choices. So as we know, health is sort of a, you know, whole basket full of lifestyle choices that we have to make, you know, including, as we mentioned, sleep, exercise, hydration, all of these things, and diet and toxicity avoidance. And we're sort of keeping our eye on all of these factors. And I always find that occasionally, you know, if it's party season, or it's one of those periods where I'm indulging, shall we say, I find it very hard to hold all those other things together. And, you know, some people, you know, like to use alcohol. My wife likes her red wine. That's her tipple. Mm-hmm. We all have our, I suppose you could call it a coping strategy in some ways, our means of, indulgence, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. But I found that when I was, indulging, it's really hard for me to hold all these things together. So
I have a picture in my head of you've got this really organized box with everything laid out just where it should be. And in the middle of it, there's a little jack in the box. And someone, when you have that, goes, and everything goes plop and falls outside the box.
Yes, absolutely. And it takes a lot of effort to sort of, pull all these things back together. Yeah. But funnily enough, I find fasting a really, really good one, because if you can, I've always found that if I can nail the fasting and I've, after a little bit of experience, I think all of us can prove to ourselves that we can. Mm-hmm. When you can get on that bandwagon just for a week, it's really easy to put everything down. The idea, for example, of starting a fast and then going out for a few bevvies on night three, you just wouldn't do it. I can't explain why, but you just wouldn't. You'd think, no, I'm fasting.
You'd be wrecked quick if you did.
Yeah. But it seems to be one of those things that sort of encompasses everything. Yes. And provides a framework for everything to sit in. So, I'm no saint, and I do permit myself periodic indulgences, and I try to view them as medicinal. There are certain creative advantages in using various herbs. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably comes down to that old cliche of just trying to balance everything.
I think so. I'm with you. I think everyone, intermittent fasting would be a tremendous way in to the game. Mm-hmm. And it's something when I started, I decided I'll just do this forever. Now this is how I eat, and it works. It works so well. I can't really describe to people what it's like. And the other thing, just time-wise, not having to stop for meals, you free up a whole ruck of time. It's amazing.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And I think that is one of the lifestyle choice changes that is really, really sustainable. I mean, personally, I skip breakfast and I eat my lunch at around about 12:30 to 1. And then my wife likes to cook an early dinner anyway. She always has. So we tend to eat at around about 5, sometimes as early as 4:30. So my eating window is about 4 to 5 hours. And I find that very, very sustainable. It's almost effortless. And then occasionally when I'm, every other weekend or just sometimes I might just have on a Sunday, I'll just have a full nosh up breakfast with the family and maybe, just break that pattern for the one day. But generally, I think that's a very achievable lifestyle pattern that probably almost anyone could adapt to. And of course you could eat breakfast and lunch and skip dinner, but I think socially that's possibly a little bit harder to achieve.
Yeah, I found it easier to go the other way. It seems to fit better by not having breakfast for me and not having what people call breakfast and not having what people call lunch. But the evening thing, I think, does seem to fit and work a lot better. Certainly that's been my experience.
Yeah, yeah. And it's really important, isn't it, to find these things that work for us, over the long term.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
In closing, is there anything else you'd like to say to anybody? Because we started on one thing, but got into something that was the kind of the culmination, really, of where you and I have been headed for a long time, which is refining this thing.
Yeah. Well, I think that maintaining our body and mind in a optimal state of health is rightly, rationally, the most important priority I've found. And I think, logically speaking, it should be everybody's, because especially in the current context of everyone scared of catching something, it's really important to learn how to maintain our health and look after our body and really aim for the century. I mean, I kind of half jokingly, but in all seriousness, tell my family I'm going to do the ton. I'm determined to do the ton. Of course, I may get hit by a bus or something at any time.
I'm going to send you a copy of that book down to have a look at, and you might be aiming for considerably more than the ton when you've read it.
Oh, great. Well, that would be fantastic. But, but my goal is that I want functionality, Adrian.
Yes.
I don't want to be an old cripple. I don't want a Zimmer frame. Nope. I don't want a one of these, you know, mobile wheelchair motorized things. I don't want any of that. I want to be functional, you know, right up till the end, or as near to the end as is feasible or feasibly achievable. And that motivates me to always keep an eye out for not only to it motivated me to educate myself as to how to operate and maintain this human body I've got, but also I try and remain open to any new ideas that you mm-hmm. hear about. And you know, infrared sauna and detoxification is one I've heard recently about, and also this blood flow restriction training for people as they age, helping them maintain muscle mass. So I think it's important for us to sort of keep our ear to the ground, even once we kind of think that we've sussed it all out. It's important to sort of, you know, yeah, keep one ear out on any new technologies, because things are always being discovered.
So. Or old technologies, that's just things are being remembered.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, I look forward to running on that same path with you, because I have my aspirations set beyond that, but I'd certainly like to give that a nice happy wave as I saunter past it.
Great. Well, what number are you going for, Adrian?
It's a lot higher.
Excellent. Yeah.
I'm not going to say it because people will go, you are off your mind, but I already know I am, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Well, that's great, isn't it? And I don't think I lost a friend just recently, a couple of years ago, 51 he was, and it was death by diet. And you know, it was a heart attack that took him, and his diet was crap. And he always acknowledged to me, you know, Nigel, I know I should do this, that, and the other, but I haven't, and blah, blah, blah. You know, the point here is it's avoidable. It really is avoidable. Yes. And achievable. These early deaths by diet, getting diabetes and cancer and these things are so avoidable. You know, any closing message for me would, I'd love to inspire people to really get interested in, you know, taking responsibility for their health, because it's so achievable and it's so empowering. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was awesome. Thank you so much, mate.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Adrian. A great pleasure always catching up with you, mate. And yeah, wonderful. Really enjoy always chatting with you, man.
No, it's really good. Yeah. And I'm looking forward to seeing you later on this year, because I will come down.